Today on the Best of Flashpoints, Obama's Predator and Reaper drone attacks in Pakistan are remote-controlled from the deserts in Nevada. Dennis Bernstein talks with Kathy Kelly. And Nora Barris Friedman is in the West Bank. She brings us a radio documentary on the struggle of one village of Palestinian refugees to keep from being dispossessed a second time. All this coming up on the Best of Flashpoints with Nora Barris Friedman and Dennis Bernstein. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our series talking with high-profile resistors of the U.S. war in Iraq, the occupation there, and the expanding war in Afghanistan. And yesterday, Barack Obama made a surprise visit to Iraq. He congratulated the troops and all Americans on a job well done there. Quite a bit of a different visit and flavor from his last anti-war visit, and people are concerned about the expanding war in Afghanistan, Pakistan. Now joining us is Kathy Kelly. Kathy Kelly is co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She is making her way to, I guess you're in Nevada now, right?
That's right, Dennis. I joined a group of people who are intent on bringing attention to the Predator and Reaper drones, the unmanned aerial vehicles that are headquartered inside of Creech Air Force Base. And I think that there is now some increasing awareness of how it is that the United States is conducting escalated warfare in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. There's increasing reliance on what might be called a sort of remote-controlled assassination squad or extrajudicial execution. The drones don't have pilots inside the airplane. The pilot is inside Creech Air Force Base or Langley Air Force Base if the pilots are working for the CIA. So we've been vigilant since April 1st. Outside the base, we hold signs that say, ground the drones lest you reap the whirlwind, and ending war, our collective responsibility, along with keep the troops home. And it's amazing the cordial response that we've had from people in the Air Force or others going inside the base. We've been given waves, peace signs, smiles, indications to keep going. And yet, they are themselves becoming very instrumental in the changing face of the United States military.
Well, Bush War Secretary, now Obama War Secretary, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, loves these drones. This is his vision for 21st century war, along with a forward-fighting force that is reinforced by depleted uranium. The drones, this is the way he wants to move. Talk a little bit about Gates and now the Obama pro-war policy. I mean, after all, when Obama says job well done in Iraq, I think he's talking about an illegal war, an occupation that destroyed a country and led to the death of about 1 million people.
Well, I think there is a certain blind side that both Mr. Gates and President Obama are not seeing. They seem not to be aware of the tremendous antagonism toward the United States that's been occasioned by a long history of United States regarding life in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan as being expendable, cheap, if you will. Right now, there are 1 million people in Pakistan who have fled their homes because they're afraid that they might be struck by a drone predator, a drone reaper. And, you know, I think if we could just imagine, what would it be like if we looked up into the skies and heard a sound that's sort of like a snowmobile or a leaf blower, and realized that vehicle up in the sky could carry two Hellfire missiles and two 500-pound bombs.
Now, Kathy, I spoke with Adam Kokesh, who you know, I'm sure, very well, an Iraq War veteran and on the board of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And we were speaking, and I asked him how he felt or when he felt these war crimes committed by the Bush administration become the war crimes of the Barack Obama administration?
Well, I think that Barack Obama is the world's chief exporter of weapons. I mean, that goes with the job. And I think that you can't look at attacks on civilian populations using conventional military force and not discuss war crimes. So the United States is certainly in the position of being easily accused of having committed war crimes and also in having given so much weaponry to Israel. And Israel has, I think, in the Operation Cast Lead assault and during those 22 days, certainly committed war crimes. And then when you think about the fact that we create and export more weapons than the next, we're six times greater in our weapon production and use than any following country. We've placed our economy on a war footing throughout a time when we could very well have been reaping a peace dividend. And I think that this is what President Obama inherits, but in the appointments that he made, which are center-rightist appointments by and large, and in his indications that it was since the time he was campaigning that there would be an uptick in military spending under an Obama administration, the clue for all of us, I think, who want to abandon the military, and I mean that, abandon the military, is that our work is the same as it was under President Bush. We have a more thoughtful and more reflective person in office, but the demonic suction cup of the military spending will exhaust our resources in ways that I think are of great threat to the security of people in the United States if we don't stand up and say, no, we don't want that crushing arm of United States imperial military might extended across the world. It takes resources we need to deal with environmental concerns, and it creates so much antagonism toward the United States that it lowers our security.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Kathy Kelly. She's co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She is part of a protest. We're going to be talking more about this with one of the organizers, but Kathy is part of a protest that is happening at a Air Force base where these drones are being produced, and it is troubling that Creech Air Force Base there in Indian Springs is at the core of these unmanned, if you will, mass murdering inventions that I guess save, as they say, U.S. lives. I do, Kathy, want to ask you about that pronoun, we, and I ask you respectfully and very seriously. And you, in the context of, say, Palestine, say we, as in meaning the United States, rushed over advanced unconventional weaponry that literally, this is a new kind of apartheid, as I have said, where you shred, you can burn the skin off of your enemy from the inside out with advanced weaponry. So do you mean you, Kathy? Do you disassociate when you say we, as in the United States, made this weaponry available? Or how do you? What's your responsibility?
Well, my responsibility is to look in the mirror and see myself as somebody who lives very, very comfortably in a society whose comfort has been enhanced because we've been able to take other people's resources at cut-rate prices, and we've been able to use Israel as a client state in the region. I'm so conscious of Dr. Said Abu Hassan, who grew up in the Lakeview neighborhood just south of where I live in Chicago, and he went on to get his MD, and I met him in an emergency room at the Shifa Hospital in Gaza, and I asked him, what should I take as a message back to people in the United States? And at first he was talking about, well, tell about all the people who need prostheses and the rehab clinics that will be needed, and then he stopped himself, and he said, I am completely wrong. Just you tell people in Chicago, in the United States, that they paid for these weapons. And so my responsibility, your responsibility, all of us, is to enhance the level of education so that people understand what our relationship is to Israel. And likewise, understand what is happening when drone attacks, drones that lift off of runways in Afghanistan and Pakistan, 15,000 miles away, are coordinated by pilots who go into dimly lit trailers and sit down in front of screens that look like video games. And we're so lucky because the Nevada Desert Experience is an organization that has called attention for a long time to the reality of our overwhelming capacity to eliminate the entire planet. But they decided to give hospitality, really, to our effort to vigil outside of the Creech Air Force Base. Jim Haber, who really is a national treasure when it comes to organizing, has been very, very hospitable and extremely talented in coordinating both projects, both the Sacred Peace Walk and also helping us to create this vigil. We call it Ground the Drones, Lest You Reap the Whirlwind.
Why don't you put Jim on, and we'll continue the dialogue. Kathy Kelly, we thank you for all your good work, and we, of course, will talk to you again soon.
All right. Thank you, Dennis. This is Jim Haber of Nevada Desert Experience.
Hi, Jim.
Hey, Dennis.
Welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're delighted to have you with us. We're full of questions that we have for you about, specifically about this operation now, this movement that you're supporting to resist these drones, where they are being made. Tell us about the vigil, but first tell us exactly what happens at Creech. Kathy mentioned that these guys sit in front of small screens there and make decisions that cost the lives of dozens, sometimes hundreds of people. Tell us about that.
Well, these unmanned or uninhabited aerial vehicles, or sometimes they refer to them as unmanned aerial systems, because they emphasize it's not just the flight thing, it's the sensors and cameras, and in the case of the Predator and Reaper drones, they're also armed with missiles, and in the case of the Reaper, they can carry bombs also. But in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, wherever, the crews on the ground there actually control them for takeoff and landing, but then they pass control to people in the U.S. There's some British officers also controlling them. And they used to just have two-person teams, as we understood, a pilot who would actually, control the guidance, but then also would fire the missiles, but then guiding them to their destination, to their target, is a sensor operator who also views the destruction. And these tend to be younger enlisted people, and they're all vulnerable. There's also a military intelligence officer who, in some cases, they do call off strikes if they think that there's going to be civilians around, and for some reason they think someone's not actually there. They do sometimes call them off, and I think they make more hay out of the times they call them off than is deserved, looking at the record of when they've carried out strikes and not gotten the, as they say, the high priority target. And AmericanProgress.org has this interactive map online that shows these airstrikes in Pakistan over time, and it's chilling to see that there was one in 2006 and then this big empty gap when they weren't doing any, and then they started doing them again, and how many just in the last 4 months that didn't hit, as they would say, a high-value target, but killed a lot of civilians.
All right, let me jump in here. That's the voice of Jim Haber. Jim Haber is the co-coordinator of the Nevada Desert Experience, which is now organizing a vigil, which is taking place tomorrow at Creech Air Force Base in Indian Springs, Nevada. Describe, what's Indian Springs, Nevada like?
Well, Indian Springs, Nevada, it's basin and range. It's in a valley surrounded by 12,000-foot mountains. The light changes throughout the day as it does in the desert. It's not a wasteland. It's incredibly beautiful, rich territory. It's not great for agriculture, but it's very alive. It's sacred land to the Western Shoshone, although Creech is also sort of in the Paiute area. but the land wasn't really sold. It's a beautiful area. There's a couple of prisons south of there. Not many of the people who work at the base actually live in Indian Springs. Most of them are in Las Vegas.
So let's just say that these guys, go through this extraordinarily beautiful valley. They commute to Las Vegas, so I guess they go to suburban and lifestyles where their kids are going to school. And so they commute to this center, may very well commit mass murder, and then go back to suburbia.
Well, yeah, it's definitely a dichotomous existence for them, to be sure.
And they never know who they kill. They never know who they kill. Not usually, they don't usually see the faces or even know the ages.
Yeah, the resolution isn't so good that they can be 100% sure that they got who they got. And if you read or listen to interviews with someone like Mark Garlasco, who used to, for the first invasion of, or the 2003 invasion of Iraq, he was a Pentagon targeting advisor, and now he works for Human Rights Watch. And, I mean, he feels like they're doing well in protecting as many civilians as possible, but I look at the record and I'm not sure how he gets that conclusion.
And so for you, you're there, you're an organizer of the protest. What kind of response do you get from official Indian Springs, and why is it important for you to be there now in front of the base?
Well, there haven't really been large scale or much of any demonstrations around the Reapers and Predators that I know of. I did see New York Times reported on a large demonstration in Pakistan, and they had a picture in the paper, but in the U.S., it's still emerging, and there's a lot of, people like the idea of being able to attack people abroad without putting, their sons or daughters or husbands and wives and all in harm's way. So we need to really challenge the infatuation with technology that we have and how it seems inherently better if we can attack our enemies without putting our people at risk. That makes sense. But in fact, as it seems to be, it's just enraging people. It's not going to pacify anyone. It's not going to whip them into submission. It's not going to beat the Pashtuns into docility. And so it's just going to enrage people more, putting us in a longer term greater risk. And, we're killing a lot of civilians. We would not stand for that. We wouldn't stand for that here. And how can we expect others to?
Well, then let me ask you the same question that I've been asking activists who have been on the front line trying to resist the occupation war in Iraq, the expanding war in Afghanistan. These drones are a part of the U.S. foreign policy. Gates has gone from the Bush administration to Obama. When do these war crimes become Obama's?
Well, I think, as soon as he's ordered a strike, which he's ordered many already that have killed many civilians, so can't hold George W. Bush all responsible. He couldn't be for anyways. Of course, you know that. Creech, it's the headquarters of these drones, these attack drones. And as we walk by the base on our peace walk to the Nevada test site, because the threat of nuclear testing is always able to come back, and so we do this peace walk from Las Vegas up to the Nevada test site, organizing that just couldn't walk past Creech and not address this scourge. This, people think a new technology is going to be worthwhile and be better and safer to use and more directed. And, I can understand thinking that logically. It's like if you can target something better and you know the person's going to be there or not, you know whether to attack or not, all of that makes logical sense. But in practice, it seems not to actually get borne out to actually reduce unintended murder. But I think, The book, it's a popular book right now, P.W. Singer, called Wired for War, And he's not really against these things, but he does, in his chapter 20, raises these legal questions that I think need to be looked at more, where the countries and the manufacturers, the laws of armed conflict that go back some years that represent an improvement in human decency, you know, that we need to embrace and not say, well, they're not carried out fully enough, so let's abandon them to a barbarity. So he says that these are not being looked into enough. They're being avoided because they're afraid of the consequences of what it means that they shouldn't be developed and utilized. And so they're shying away from looking at these things as required by international law.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. But I want to say, again, Jim Haber, that you are the co-coordinator of the Nevada Desert Experience. You are organizing. This will be taking place tomorrow, a vigil at Creech Air Force Base in Indian Springs, Nevada, where these squadrons of predator drones are controlled, and where the kills, the mass murders, sometimes they'll hit a wedding party, who knows, but they won't know the names of their victims. It's a very important protest you're organizing, and if people want to learn more about it, is there a website, a phone number they can check out?
Yeah, absolutely. And the vigil's been going on since April 1st. I just want to emphasize that. It's not just a one-day thing. But our website, NevadaDesertExperience.org.
All right. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Flashpoints as we continue to talk to some of the leading war resistors in this country about the expanding wars, continuing war in Iraq, expanding war in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and of course the unending violence around the occupation of Palestine. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
It's an honor. Honor. Thank you very much.
In Occupied Palestine, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. On Sunday evening, Israeli Orthodox settlers, backed by soldiers and police, attacked Palestinian residents of the Saadiyya neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem, 4 days after the settler group invaded the home of the Jaber family and extrajudicially evicted them. The settlers claim ownership of the Jaber home and several other homes in Saadiyya, even after an Israeli court had decided to examine an appeal filed by Palestinian families contesting the legitimacy of the settlers' claims. Three Palestinians were injured and several were beaten and arrested by Israeli police when residents of the neighborhood attempted to protect the Jaber home and restrain the settlers and Israeli forces. At the same time, near Saadiyya in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, Palestinian families there are also facing expanding settler attacks, evictions, and court battles that threaten their homes. After Palestinians were expelled and dispossessed from their villages and towns in 1948, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, cooperated with the Jordanian government in 1956 to build housing units for refugees in Sheikh Jarrah, within an agreement that would trade UNRWA refugee benefits for permanent housing for these relocated Palestinian families. In 1972, however, Israeli settler groups began what would be a lengthy process of filing legal suits over land titles, claiming ownership of the property, and pursuing subsequent eviction of the Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah. Forged documents of land ownership were submitted by the settler groups, resulting in a court order that forced the Palestinian families to pay rent. Although in 2006, when the documents were proved fraudulent, the Israeli court ruled the settlers' claim void, but did not reinstate the Palestinian families' rightful ownership to their land. However, it was too late. In 2008, the settler group sold the land in Sheikh Jarrah to an Israeli investment company which currently plans to demolish the neighborhood and build 200 housing units for exclusive Jewish use. After these plans were made, settlers began invading and occupying Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. Maher Hanoun sits in the veranda of his modest but classic Jerusalem house. Green clematis vines crawl along the outside stone wall. Children play a game of soccer in the alleyway across the street. Hanoun's quiet home finds itself in the direct crosshairs of what he calls the latest round of Israeli colonization in this area.
My name is Maher Hanoun. I'm living at Jerusalem at the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. And I give you a little speech about our neighborhood. It's about 28 houses. We are 500 people living here. and we are took those houses from Jordanian government and UNRWA, which is mean that we are here legally because there is an agreement between us and between Jordanian government. So the Israelian came at 72, they claimed that they own this land. And we are at the court since 37 years. And I will tell you about our situation now. Now they claim that they own this land and we have to pay money as a rent. So our lawyer bring a lot of documents, more than 13 documents, which prove that a Palestinian guy is on this land. But the problem here that the court, she didn't want to hear and she didn't want to see all those documents. I hope there is a justice here, but I don't think, because as I told you, 37 years we are suffering at the court and they don't want to see the documents. Always they said, you are late to bring the documents. And the settlers don't late, they bring a document which they claim they own this land before 130 years. They don't late, but we are late.
And apparently these kinds of documents are often forged, the settlers' documents that they bring to the court. You know, like they're fake. Can you talk a little bit about why the Israeli courts would favor the fake documents brought by the illegal settlers and not respect the actual documents brought by the indigenous Palestinians of this area?
Also, not the court helped the settlers. Also, three departments in Israel, which is especially for the paper, also they help it because they know, as I see you, that they fake the paper and they don't give any attention or any matter for this. Also, the court helped him with a very bad decision, which gave it to us. They helping him with this fake paper. So they need the land empty without people. That's the reason. They need all the land here at East Jerusalem, and they want empty Jerusalem from Palestinian people. To let 1 million settlers come and live here.
How many Palestinians live in the Sheikh Jarrah area, do you know?
At our neighborhood live 500 persons, but at the old Sheikh Jarrah about 2,000 persons. And there is planning to damage our houses and build 200 houses for settlement. Also not here, also at this neighborhood, they will build 36 houses at land, and also they will to build another 100 houses for another land, which is mean they want to cut East Jerusalem by settlement to let the Palestinian people, they can't reach the old city and the Al-Aqsa and the church there also.
Maher Hanoun, can you talk a little bit about what happened this past week with the court orders and what the Palestinian community is doing in response to that?
First, as I told you, our lawyer bring a new 13 documents which prove that an Palestinian on this land. Also, we have support from the Palestinian media. They support us, they try to help us. They, if we need one lawyer or two lawyers, they try to help us legally. Also by the media, and there is a connection between Palestinian media and Jordanian government and Turkish government, and also with with U.S. government. Also Mrs. Clinton, a secretary, she's talk about East Jerusalem and what happened here, And what they do, it's not helping the peace, because if they took all the land here, there is no capital for Palestinian state later. And I don't know at what area they will negotiate. There is no area, there is no people here. And they want to put it, they want to take the land without people, and there is no nothing to negotiate it later. So that they will, that what they try to do. And also I have here international people and Israeli people which is believe in justice and freedom. They came day and night sleep with us to support us and to as you to hear the story and to see the truth on the land what happening on.
Is the Palestinian community of Sheikh Jarrah going to appeal the court's recent decision from last week?
Now, after the middle court refused our case at the middle court, our lawyer yesterday was at the high court, and until now we are waiting the decision. Maybe at Sunday it will be. But even the high court didn't give anything help us, which is mean that we don't stop this fighting about our houses here. We will go even to the international court to prove that we are here, because as I told you, I am born here, and also my kids and all my family was here. It's our houses, and as you know, we are refugees. And here at East Jerusalem, we are under occupation. And we don't own nothing, no another land or houses, just this house. I will fight to the last moment to be here, because that's what I have. There is no place to go, and I will be homeless later.
Can you talk about how the settlers themselves have been able to take over homes and what that's like? What that's like for Palestinian families when these settler groups come in and take over homes?
You see, when you see the settlers take your houses and damage your houses and build another houses for settlers, sure, it's hurt you. They built shelter houses on our dreams and our hopes to let us homeless, to let us move from East Jerusalem to go to West Bank or to Jordan. They, as I told you, they need the land empty without people. Because of that, we will be here and will be fight for our rights as a human being. We are here refugees and we are a human being. We are not coming from the moon. We are here since hundreds of years. I will ask the judge if he can tell me from where his father or his grandfather. I can prove from my where my father and the grandfather they was at Palestine. But if he can prove from where, I will agree with him later.
Sheikh Nasser Al-Gawi is also facing eviction and home demolition in the same neighborhood. 7 years ago, he was forced out of his home by Israeli police and lived in a tent beside his house.
In 2002, there is a decision of the court, the middle court, to evacuate me and Maher Hannoun. And actually, there is evacuate me and Maher Hannoun, and we live in tent beside the house till 4 months. And after 4 months, I haven't any place to go, and no house, no land. And we returned back to the houses till 2006. And in 2006, there is laws in the High Court, and the High Court said there is no enough documents to the other side and the Arab side also. So there is don't feel good when they're lose in 2006. They went and they sell this land to another association, to destroy these houses and to build 250 units for the settlers' people. And now we have a new document from Turkey and from the Archive of the State of Israel. It said that this land, the ownership is Darwish Suleiman Darwish Hijazi. And we send it to the court, and the court said, okay, it's a very old paper, we don't take it, and the decision is negative. And we went to the evacuate decision, or to active it, and we have to go to the high court. Maybe the high court give a free decision. And we hope only for goods and to bring my house and to peace.
And you said that you were first forced into a tent beside your house for 4 months.
Yes.
Can you talk about what that process was like? Like, take us from the day that they said that you needed to leave and how it was for those 4 months living beside your house, which you could not enter.
It's been very easy. You know, it's only to defend my house, because I'm sure it's my house, it's not the other house. Because there is the Ministry of Houses, his name is Beni Alon. He is a crazy settler. And he came and asked me, okay, Mr. Nasser, how many people you are inside this tent? I said it was 17. And he said to me, okay, take $17 million and leave the zone of the municipality of Jerusalem. I don't say go to Austria or to Germany or France or Jordan or Saudi Arabia. Okay, just leave the zone of the municipality of Jerusalem. I'm said, oh, crazy. If it's at your house, you can't imagine it. You have to pay more money to bring your house, if it's at your house. And he said, oh, you are crazy. And he's gone.
So he offered you $17 million.
Yes. And, you know, $17 million you cannot pay for my members. So I'm born in this house, you know, not in hospital. I'm born in this house. So $17 million is not money. If you imagine it, your members, your blood here is mixed in this land, everything.
One family in particular has received some attention from reporters and international human rights groups. After the Israeli court ruled in favor of settlers to evict them, the Al-Kurd family were thrown out of their home in November of 2008 and have since lived in a canvas tent below their house in a former trash dump as settlers move freely in and around the Al-Kurd property. The court based the eviction on the Al-Kurd family's refusal to pay rent to the settlers. Fawzia Abdelkader Jabal Al-Kurd, better known as Kamel, speaks to Flashpoints inside her tent. I asked her to explain her situation.
She's a refugee. Her father came from Talbiyeh and their father-in-law came from Jaffa. And she used to live in Sheikh Jarrah.
And tell us a little bit about how you came to be living in this tent. What happened?
طبعا في ليلة 19 اجت قوة كتير يعني قوة فظيعة كتير واخرجتني من البيت بالعراء وساعة 3:30 بالليل حوالي 50 واحد دخل
On the 9th of November she was sitting in their home with her husband and like 50 soldiers came in with 3 women soldiers. They entered the house with settlers. They occupied the house. They throw both of them outside of the house. Her husband immediately had a heart attack because they throw him in another separated room than her. And they didn't let the ambulance to come in, so they had to take their father's, her sons to the hospital. He had his first attack. Then she, after they release her from the, you know, investigation, they brought her back here. So she decided to build this tent, and they brought her husband back to here. The next day he got another heart attack, and then they took him to a hospital next by, and then he passed away after a week.
Allah rahmahu. So, describe your house. Describe the history of your house. Describe the things that went on, you know, in your life, in your husband's life there at the house.
طبعا شو اشرح حياتي كلها في ذكرياتي كلها في خلفت اولادي في جوزت اولادي في حصلت صرت جدة وانا في في الاخر القيت بالشارع.
She can't explain to you. This is a question that it's like for her it's very funny because this is a home, this is a place that you born, you gave birth to children, you saw your first niece in it, your first nephew. It's like all the history inside it. Her husband, in the beginning, they were living there. She have all this, you know, the nicest memory and the oldest memory and the suffering memory. So she, as much as she can be and, you know, very specific, it's something that she cannot answer. It's like your own home. So.
And what's the status of the house now? And how close are you right now in your tent to the house?
الوضع البيت هلأ فيه مستوطنين شباب بحطوا فيه بتناوبوا بقعدوا في البيت وقريب من الخيمة للبيت حوالي بس فيش 200 متر طول يعني أو 150 متر طول لو بدك تمشي بالإجر بس 150 متر طول بس.
It's 150 meters from here. You just walk from it because it's very close and nowadays settlers living in it and settlers are actually controlling on it and they have shifts every 5 you know of days or 2 days they will shift for other groups and she cannot even reach it. She can reach it by walk but she cannot enter it actually.
And all of your belongings, all of your books, everything is still inside.
ولا شيء اخذت طلعوني في البيجامه هو طلعوا في البيجامه.
She didn't take anything because the minute they enter the house they throw them outside.
Can you talk a little bit about the legal fight and what's happening with that?
احنا قضائيا اول شيء قانونيا سليم القانون 100% لانه احنا لما اخذنا البيوت هون بالشيخ جراح احنا مهجرين من القدس الغربيه واخذنا هذه البيوت على سبب.
She said that the legal things is very difficult because nowadays we are trying to prove that and we have the proof that we went to the Ottoman archives. We have too many documents that prove that this land actually belonged to a guy called Salman Darwish Hijazi. That the Israelis actually by illegal documents, by fake documents, they are trying to prove that this is their own land, which is actually is fake because since the beginning the owner of the land was Palestinians. Now the Jews actually trying, or the settlers actually trying to prove that it is not. And in a way, when the court is actually deciding and, you know, relying on courts that it was before, not looking more deeply to the cases, it's very difficult to have a decent decision. So in this case, in our case, what she's saying is that there is no correct decision. There is no, a decision that it's for Palestinians. They all will say, no, it's a settlement, it's their settlements, it's the settlements. And what she's trying to prove that it's also, in a long time ago, this land was Jordanian. So how come now the Israeli claims that they have it?
And this tent now has become a very important and popular symbol of resistance within the community, but also it's traveled. I mean, you know, we hear about this, you know, 10,000 miles away. What can you say about the spirit of this community and the support that this community has given you?
أول شيء هي أنا ما إلي أي علاقة بأي خيمة، أنا إلي علاقة بخيمتي، أنا هاي الخيمة انفرضت علي مش أنا الفرضت علي لأنه أنا انطردت من البيت أول وثاني.
It's very difficult to explain it because it's something that it's belonging to everybody in the neighborhood actually will have faced the same thing and she's refusing to say I will stay here all my life in this tent. There is one case that she will leave this tent, it's only when she go back to her home, which it seems like this neighborhood actually all of them are suffering from eviction order and they will have sooner or later the same thing. So in a way it's like home, it's gonna be this area full with tents, so it doesn't matter if you have in Silwan because it's Silwan soon will have the same thing, Atur will have the same thing. So it's like something that it's actually now it's like a fashion in the Israelis you know rules that these tents are actually controlling the whole thing by evacuation orders, by demolishing orders, by all kind of orders.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio as we investigate the situation for Palestinians facing settler colonialism inside occupied East Jerusalem.
On Sunday, the Israeli High Court rejected the Sheikh Jarrah community's appeal against evictions and home demolitions. Before I returned to the neighborhood, I interviewed Jimmy Johnson, international coordinator with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions in Jerusalem.
In Sheikh Jarrah, for a large part of it, is built as a refugee community, built by UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency, after the 1948 war. And the UNRWA, working with the Jordanian government, which occupied the West Bank and East Jerusalem at the time, got building permits and residency rights for certain degrees of numbers of refugees, and they were granted titles to the land so that they would no longer be counted as refugees. It was a resettlement program of sorts. And what has happened since 1967, though, after Israel's occupation of East Jerusalem and West Bank began, is that some of the titles have been challenged in Israeli courts. One of the ways that many settlements have been founded here inside East Jerusalem and also in the West Bank is finding land that was owned by Jews prior to 1948 and then using the bureaucracy to try and reclaim the land. In some cases, this is done with a legitimate tie to previous ownership, such as in the settlement of Kfar Etzion, south of Bethlehem. There was a kibbutz prior to 1948 called Kfar Etzion, and so that's one of the ways that that settlers gain property. And in theory, it's not even really a bad law. Although if it was applied universally, you'd find it to be the least popular law in the history of Israel to have all pre 1948 property returned to its original owners, because it's the whole country. So instead, this law is indicative and demonstrative of this hierarchy of privilege, the official hierarchy of privilege we have here between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs. And in the case of Sheikh Jarrah, this is compounded by the fact that this law is being invoked, this restitution of property is being invoked with fraudulent documents even. Which is another way that settlers sometimes gain property, is by straight fraud. Inside the Israeli legal system, all of this can be challenged. You know, Israel has all of these laws and all of this, and we can go to court to challenge these things. On rare occasions, we might even win. Generally speaking, we don't. In the case of fraudulent documents, what the court oftentimes finds is that, these documents are fake, but it wasn't through any blame of the settlers, and they can't be punished for someone else's crime, for someone else's fraud. And that's one of the ways that settlers get property, and that's what's going on in Sheikh Jarrah right now. There are four houses in the Shimon HaTzadik settlement, which is nearby the Yanun and other families that are facing confiscation. There are four houses there that were owned by Jews prior to 1948. And even people inside the community say that, you know what, yeah, that's kind of their houses. And they still oppose it because it's still a settlement. And, of course, it's still indicative of this hierarchy of privilege. But the bigger claim is that with these other 28 units, one of which has already been confiscated, the Al-Kurd family, there was no previous ownership of this land. There was an old rental agreement under Ottoman times, nothing to do with titles of the land or anything like this. And instead, there have been forged documents saying that there was owned by Jews. And this is the mechanism that's being used. And unfortunately, they've lost in court as well. And so the only recourse that remains is international pressure. It's the only way that the Yanun and other families are not going to be evicted from their houses.
And Jimmy, the Israeli court has been really kind of flip-flopping on this issue over the past few years. In 2006, the court ruled in favor of the Palestinian families and said that the settlers could not evict these families. Mm-hmm. And then in 2008, they reversed their decision and ruled in favor of the settlers. And again, just this past weekend, mm-hmm. they ruled against the Palestinians again, who filed an appeal against that decision. How can you assess the role of the Israeli court right now?
Schizophrenia is probably the best way to go about it. A lot of times, in theory, we don't have a constitution. There's the basic law, but in theory, the majority of the legal mechanisms here are precedent-based law, and so each high court ruling should form the policy for the next one. But instead, we oftentimes have grossly contradictory rulings on the exact same issue. You can bring the same complaint about the wall in two different areas and come up with two different rulings on it. And so, in this sense, there's not an easily observable external logic. And the best explanation is that the court rulings tend to change a bit with both the security atmosphere and political leanings, not just amongst the people in the court themselves, but inside of Israel and inside of the international community, and acting a bit of a litmus test of sorts.
Can you talk about what this means in terms of like the entire context of occupied East Jerusalem mm-hmm. right now and the settler movement and, of course, the new Knesset and Avigdor Lieberman, who is a settler himself? Take us through what's happening right now.
It's a couple of things. The peripheral movements inside of Israel, including the settler movement, which has never been a mainstream movement, have always had a disproportionate amount of power due to the way that the Israeli government is set up. For example, in these last elections, the party that won the most seats, the Kadima, won 28 out of 120 seats. And you need 61 to form a governing coalition. And so what this means is that if you try to put a coalition together, you need the support of these peripheral parties. And it gives them, for example, the National Union and Habayit HaYehudi and all of these parties. They have far more power than the 4 or 5 seats that they won in Knesset. Their power seems more like a 20-seat party. And for this reason, it makes, and in the context, of course, of a Netanyahu-Lieberman government, it makes it all the more dangerous, I think. Now, with regards to the Judaization of East Jerusalem, I'm pretty sure that neither the Jerusalem municipality nor the Israeli government has any illusions about being able to evict the Palestinians from East Jerusalem. They can take over specific areas, and the zoning and planning and transfers of property from Palestinians to settlers certainly are mechanisms of demographic control. But at the end of the day, this isn't 1948, and Israel can't get away with it. With what it got away with then, and in this context, I think. Without trying to minimize the personal trauma inflicted on these individual families in Sheikh Jarrah, the bigger question in East Jerusalem is of the large settlements. The total number of units that can be built could house a little less than 1,000 people in Sheikh Jarrah if the settlers have their wildest fantasies come true. Whereas just outside of East Jerusalem, in the Maale Adumim's new settlement area, could have as many as 10,000 new settlers, which totally dominate the urban infrastructure of East Jerusalem and prevent it from having any type of viable economic activity in the future. And you find that's the same in a lot of ways with the various settler movements, and that. The popular image of a settler, both in the Israeli mind but also in the international public, is a man with a kippah, a collar, and a machine gun, you know, and who's probably a religious nationalist or someone who sees themselves as on the forefront of a messianic movement. They're generally thought of in that sense. And it's probably not possible to make a direct line between who we would call an ideological settler like that, and an economic settler, people who live in settlements for economic incentives. But out of the around 500,000 total settlers, it's probably fair to say that around 80,000 are what we call this popular image of a settler. And they tend to live in small settlements that don't dominate the infrastructure. The exception to that is, of course, Kiryat Arba and the settlements in the old city of Hebron, because it intrudes directly into a Palestinian urban area. The other ideological settlements are at best peripheral. And there's ones like Yitzhar and Itamar, which were founded in 1971 and 1973, that still have yet to reach 800 total people, because no one wants to live there, because the people who live there are ideological extremists in the bad sense of the word, and you know, crazy and whatever else you want to say. And generally speaking, Israelis who tend to see ourselves as like secular liberal type folks, they're not quite so, you know, they can't really identify with that. That national religious stuff, that's a little out there. But they have no problem with their cousin who lives in Maale Adumim, which is a gigantic settlement that dominates East Jerusalem, or Pisgat Ze'ev, which has 55,000 people. You know, these are very mainstream, and these are what dominate the geography of the West Bank and reorient the entire country to be to have these urban settlements be part of the Israeli urban sphere, be part of the Tel Aviv metropolitan area or the Jerusalem metropolitan area.
That was Jimmy Johnson of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Yesterday, after word got out that the Israeli High Court rejected the neighborhood community's appeal late on Sunday, I went back to the home of Maher Hanun in Sheikh Jarrah. Okay, so today is Monday, and I'm back at Maher Hanun's house in Sheikh Jarrah in occupied East Jerusalem. Maher, give us your reaction to what happened yesterday in the Israeli High Court.
I feel it's a political court, not it's a civilian court, because the judge said to our lawyers after he bring 13 new documents that he's late. I don't believe that if he bring a new proof that he's late. And as I told you, there is no judge can take the ownership of the Israeli land and give it to Palestinian, and which proved that 37 years we are fighting at the court, which proved that all the judge there was not give justice, and also the Israeli department, they helped the settlers to fake the papers. Because of that, I see no Israeli judge can give us our right. And it's a political decision to not take our proof.
Maher, what do you think is going to happen next? How are you preparing to resist the settlers who are going to try and evict you now?
So we are here, civilian people. We have an international people with us and Israeli people, which is believe that we are right. We are fighting by our bodies and our voice. The most important thing is to let all the people around the world know our problem and know our situation here. And I'm so glad there are the international people helping us because they believe in human rights. So later, we will be homeless. We don't have any land or any apartment to be with. And as you know, we are refugees here, and we do not have nothing. Just this house. I born here, and also my kids born here, and I do not have nothing. Just this house. Because of that, I will fight for the last moment at this home, during the court, during the international court. By diplomatic pressure, what I can do, I will do it.
Maher Hanun facing eviction and house demolition in Sheikh Jarrah. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, reporting from occupied East Jerusalem, Palestine. And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.